Let's get on to our main speaker for the evening. Ray?
My name is Ray O'Keefe, and I'm an alcoholic. I am a member of the world-famous Mamaroneck Group, which meets at Mamaroneck, New York. You've heard of that group, no doubt. I bring you the warm and the fraternal greetings of the world-famous Mamaroneck Group. I am authorized by our steering committee to wish you a successful convention. The vote of our committee was 11 to 7. I've enjoyed my time being here. I congratulate you on your geography. This is a garden. It really is. It is paradise. It's the Garden of Eden. And unlike the original garden, yours is only enhanced by the fall. Just testing the level, you understand. I've also been in AA a long time, and I want to tell you something else. I don't want to be critical. I have seen some very crooked raffles in AA. But this one exceeded even the worst that I've ever seen. All the locals won. Nobody from out of town won anything. It was also nice to meet people here that I've met before in various parts of California that I've traveled to, and I've met some of my friends here. And I've met a number of the Al-Anon ladies, and the Al-Anon meeting this afternoon was well attended. And that surprised me somewhat, because I understood that there was a very important meeting of Al-Anon being held in Lake Tahoe this afternoon. The meeting was being held in the mother church of all Al-Anon, the Church of Our Lady of Perpetual Revenge. Let me tell you about my drinking. I don't want you to miss any of this. Thrill a minute. I grew up in one of the neighborhoods in New York City, and my neighborhood was rough, and it was tough, and it was Irish. Now, you may not understand it here in the country, but they drank in that neighborhood. You would actually see people on the sidewalk under the influence of alcohol. Hard to believe. If you looked at where I'd live, you see a little drinking. My mother, the widow O'Keefe, was known to take a drink from time to time. And when the pressure got on, Kitty would go for the light wines and the spirits. And something would fly, usually one of the children. My brother Billy, on the other hand, was a bad drinker. And in a neighborhood of Irish drunks, Billy O'Keefe stood out as a drunk. So when I showed up at the local joint and ordered up whatever it was they were serving 14-year-olds that afternoon, no one paid any attention to me. It was just another O'Keefe coming through the system. I don't really remember what they gave me that day. I suspect it was a beer. That was the neighborhood drink. But whatever it was, I liked it. I liked everything about it. I liked the way it looked. I liked the way it smelled. And I liked the way it tastes. And I liked what it did for my head. And I liked the noise and the smoke and the confusion. And I liked the fistfights and the Irish music. I liked the bullshit. That's what I really liked. I was going through the parochial school system, in a manner of speaking. And I got into all of the difficulties and troubles you might imagine a young man would get into trying to go through that system drunk. I was thrown out of high school a number of times. I held a neighborhood record for being thrown out of high school, a record that was previously established by my brother Billy. When I was finished with high school, or more properly put, when they were finished with me, because someone made a mistake in a small school in New England, I got a chance to leave the neighborhood, and I went off to college. And when I got up there, my drinking changed. I found that every time I changed my environment, my drinking would change. When I got up there, there were no bars in that state. There were just restaurants. And these people sat around tables, and they drank beer out of bottles, and they sang college songs, and they wore white shoes in the wintertime. Being a man of no particular moral fiber, I got a pair of white shoes. I learned the words to some of those college songs. I got very collegiate. World War II was just about over, and things were relatively safe, and it was a little slow on the campus. So one day I got a haircut and joined the Navy. And I ended up in a minesweeper that was tied up in San Francisco. And I hate to be indelicate at such a nice gathering, but I have to tell you, I had a lot of trouble with my kidneys when I drank. And in the Navy, we slept three to a tier. And a new man slept on top. Now, don't get ahead of me, lady. This is not easy here. I came back from my first liberty in San Francisco with all the beer and me I could buy. And I went to sleep, and I had one of these attacks. And I met the fellow that slept below me that night. I guess he figured he'd be wet sometime in his naval career. It just hadn't occurred to him it would happen while he was sleeping. I was immediately transferred to a lower bunk. The rest of my naval career was uneventful. I came back home. When it was over, I was unhonored, undecorated, unloved. And I came back to the neighborhood, and everything was under control in the neighborhood. The widow was out in the weeds somewhere. My brother Billy was absent without leave from the New York City Police Department, having invited a citizen of the Puerto Rican ancestry off a five-story roof. The citizen bounced and lived to identify the Irish cop. My brother Billy went west and went into a safer line of work. He joined the Marine Corps. The 5220 Club was available for heroes. I qualified for a few checks. I gravitated to the local joint. I took up the game of shuffleboard. And I was planning a life of petty crime with some of my boyhood companions. When I had one of those clear thoughts that come by, I recalled that I'd been to college. So I got on a bus and I went back up there. And I arrived in the middle of a blizzard. And I walked into this place, and there they were, sitting around the table, drinking beer out of bottles, singing those songs, wearing those shoes. So I got another pair of shoes. And now a grateful government was sending a check every month, so I was relatively solvent and therefore moderately drunk all the time. And I was staggering around the campus one day in my usual shape, and I noticed a list of names on a bulletin board of people who were qualified to graduate, and my name was on the list. And that was very good news. I thought I had another year to go. So I called the widow and made this announcement, and she came north for this great event. And that was a rather tender sight, the widow and her youngest child staggering around under the elms. About 10 years later, I served as a trustee of that college, and I'd go to meetings, and they were still talking about my mother. It's not so often in the state of Vermont they see a little old lady get off a train drunk at 9 o'clock in the morning. When I came back to the neighborhood after college, the question was what to do, and my uncles, who ran the family, very Irish mob, just like Frank's family, the uncles ran it, and they had voted unanimously that I become a New York City policeman, because that's what my father had been, that's what my brother had been, that's what all my uncles and my cousins were doing, except for the two morons that worked for the telephone company. And I told them that I wasn't going to do that, that
that I had received a scholarship to law school and I'd be unemployed for the next several years. And that was received with mixed emotions, but that's what happened. I went to law school, and my drinking changed again. I didn't know anything about lawyers or law school. There were no lawyers in my neighborhood. We had cops and we had priests. We really didn't need any lawyers. I hate to be disloyal to the profession that's done so well for me, but I have to tell you that when I got to law school, I found I was in the company of the greatest collection of stiffs that had ever assembled under one roof. These guys were deadly. They all had eyeglasses and they all wore a suit with a vest. So as soon as I got into uniform and I got a pair of glasses that I didn't need, I looked around for somebody to drink with. My mother always told me, play with nice boys your own age. But nobody drank in that crowd. They're all studying. They're all grinding away. So I became the biggest grind they ever had in that place. And I didn't drink at all in my first year, very rarely in the next 2 years. I stopped drinking. And as a result of that, I did well. And when I came out of school, I was taken into a lodge, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, Wall Street law firm. They hired me as sort of the resident immigrant. And my superiors there, who were very wise, determined that I become a trial lawyer. And so I was sent up to the courthouse in New York City to learn my trade. And I wasn't in the courthouse very long when I discovered that all the smart guys were across the street in a saloon. So I moved my office into the saloon, and I discovered a new way to drink. Very civilized, very genteel. Very few members of the profession were knocking down shots and beers where anybody could see them. I discovered scotch in a tall glass with ice. You sip on that. It takes a little while, but it gets the job done. I was introduced to all of the mysteries and all of the rituals that surround the very, very dry martini. And to this night, to this minute, my love, my admiration, and my affection for the very, very dry martini is surely the greatest case of unrequited love the world has ever seen. I was so loyal to those things. After about a year of being civilized, it became necessary in my natural development that I be married. And I had located a lady, my wife, my current wife. I always call her my current wife. I find it keeps her on her toes. We got married right before the war. I'm not talking about any of the world wars. I'm talking about the war between me and my current wife. And we settled down and set up housekeeping, and she then began to deliver children in a rather boring and monotonous fashion. And with the regularity that's known only to the devout Roman Catholic. And after a couple of those events, after the second one, I received a phone call from the law school I had attended, and I was directed to see the dean. So I went down to see the dean, and without any fanfare or anything else, he appointed me to the faculty, and I became Professor O'Keefe. And I responded with great alacrity, and there I was, the boy professor. And I was a little overcome by that appointment, and I really did not know what there was in my background to justify it. And I also knew that I drank a great deal and that everybody I knew drank a great deal. So I decided I would control my drinking. And I entered into a phase of controlled drinking. I was then 26 years of age when it was necessary for me to control my drinking. And I was very unsuccessful at controlling my drinking. But as the years went by with the teaching, as it turned out, I turned out to be a good teacher. I was a good teacher. And I realized that after a few years. And so there was no need to even try to control the drinking. So I went back out to drink the way I like to drink. And I only knew the one way to drink. My father died when I was 2, and my brother Billy was 4 years older. And Billy was my instructor and my hero, and I did everything like Billy. And I drank like Billy. I drank until I fell down, or the place went on fire, or the cops arrived. I used to see people leaving, and I would wonder where they were going. I mean, the whiskey was here, and they were going out. That used to puzzle me. And in this period of time, I did a lot of other things that aren't important. I did all of the things because of the position that I held as a professor of law in a very, very good law school, a very well-known law school. A lot of other things happened to me. I was appointed to this and appointed to that. And like Tully, I was a commissioner, and I was all kinds of things. And I roamed around the city of New York. And I did all the things that you would expect a young, drunken lawyer, egomaniac would do. He was terribly on the make, as I was. And I don't recall any of that with any satisfaction at all now that the years have gone by, except that I do look back with some satisfaction. But I was one of the initial group of men in the very, very early days who surrounded the candidacy of a young senator from Massachusetts that you will remember. And in this period of time, too, I bought a large, semi-authentic colonial home in a village called Larchmont, New York, a village which abounds in semi-authentic colonial homes. And we had it up to 5 or 6 children, and a very nice house, and the usual number of motor vehicles, and the usual memberships, and the usual clubs, and I was working and teaching and politicking. I even ran for office one time and lost. And I was doing all of these things, and had you asked me at that time, at age 34, how I was doing, I would have told you I was doing very well. In fact, I would have told you I was doing very well, whether you asked me or not, was one of my favorite themes, the American dream. The truth of the matter was, at this time, at age 34, I turned into a daily drunk, and my day would have killed an ordinary man. I used to come to in the morning in that wet sack, because the problem with the kidneys had continued unabated all of those years, and I would struggle out of my damp bed, and I'd begin my morning calisthenics, and my calisthenics were performed kneeling on the floor of a bathroom with my head in a bowl. And I would have all the water running, water in the shower and the water in the tub and the water in the sink, because I did not want Ms. O'Keefe and all of those little O'Keefes to know that Professor O'Keefe was dying. And I would come downstairs in my sincere suit with the vest, carrying my shoulder over my shoulder, much like Santa Claus, a sack of wet laundry. Because Ms. O'Keefe told me that the diaper service was for the children. And she did not think that a lady of her extreme breeding ought to do the wash of a 34-year-old bedwetter. If you can imagine a man of my stature in the community, starting off each morning with a load of wash. But once I had my wash out of the way, help was at hand. I used to keep a quart of vodka in the refrigerator. My children call that Daddy's juice. And I would take a few bangs on Daddy's juice. And then the question was, would I throw up in front of all these people? I knew that if I lit up a cigarette, I was all over. Sooner or later, I would take the train into New York City, and I'd go to Grand Central, and I don't know how much you know about Grand Central. It's really not a railroad terminal. It is a collection of saloons that are connected by tunnels. And I'd tear around the tunnels, and I'd pop up like a mole here or there and do a repair job. And then I would head for that very imposing institution where I worked, and as soon as I got up there, the first thought was, how do I get out of here? And I'd get out, and I'd tear across town to a law firm, a very prestigious law firm, where I'd run in and steal $20 every morning from the petty cash. Just drove several bookkeepers to distraction. There's nothing like giving a drunk money. It's like whole blood. I'd be out in the street, into a taxi, and I'd go right to where I belong, the bar down by the courthouse. And by this time, the other lawyers were treating me like a mascot or a playmate or something, and I'd throw up my dough, and I'd buy a drink, and they'd buy a drink, and the bartender would buy a drink. We'd have a hell of a time. And maybe somebody would do a little business, and maybe they wouldn't, and maybe something gets settled, and maybe it wouldn't. Didn't make much difference. The booze would keep coming, and then maybe we'd have lunch, and maybe we wouldn't. Didn't make a hell of a lot of difference. Very congenial type of atmosphere. And I had even risen in the academic ranks, so I had set my own schedule, and my schedule called for me to be there at 2, and I would show up at 2, and I would shortchange those poor children. Those poor, unwilling, unsuspecting sophisticates who had come to study law at my feet, and I would shortchange them terribly, and then I would be out in the street into a cab, and I'd tear over to Grand Central to commute. Now, even though I grew up in the city, I understood the theory of commuting. Commuters are entitled to a drink before they get on the train. So I'd have 10 or 12... And then I would take a train going north. It didn't have to go to Larchmont. North was good enough for me. And I got to see a great deal more of Bridgeport, Connecticut than any civilized man ought have to. Sooner or later, I'd arrive home and I'd bounce off a few walls and get what's left of daddy's juice out of the refrigerator and fill up an old jelly glass that some kid had left laying around and inquire if anybody wanted a martini. But I was the only one that drank in that house. And so I'd have 4 or 5 pops, and then I would eat or not eat, depending on my mood. Evenings I would spend in civic endeavor. Lawyers are very big for civic endeavor. Civic endeavor by me was cracking up the car or puking on some hostess's sofa or playing a little grab-ass with the ladies of Larchmont. And a sorrier-looking crop you have never seen. Most evenings, I would just stay home and vegetate, and I would watch television with one eye, like just trying to get those sets to come together. And I would drink, and I'd watch the television with the one eye, and they would go through the programs, and through the news, and through the late show, and on into the morning. And then my big moment would come. When they played the Star Spangled Banner. And the Marines would go up Mount Suribachi. And those planes would fly by. And they'd be playing that song. And I would cry. Oh. I would weep and sob and cry. And then I'd go upstairs and wet the bed. That's it. Now, this is not once in a while. This is every day. Weekends, I would save for binges. And if everybody around me would mind their own business, which was extremely rare, I could get drunk 3 times on Saturday and 3 times on Sunday. Well, I don't have to tell you, if you've ever been married, that while all of this was going on, Mrs. O'Keefe was not entirely silent. From time to time, she would have the temerity to suggest that there was something radically wrong with the way I drank. But I pay no attention to her. Why should I? First of all, she's a wife, and they don't know anything. Secondly, she is not an attorney, and I would tell her that. And then we would have the discussion, and I would have to explain things to her. And I would tell her about the relativity of drinking, some people drink more than other people. It's all relative. And that I didn't drink that much. As a matter of fact, I would say to her, I don't even drink as much as my mother. And she would say, nobody drinks. And that would end that discussion. I'd be gone for a week. You know, you can't stay when people are insulting your mother. You got to take a position. Well, this drove her crazy, and she went nuts, and so she betook herself to her physician, who, as you might imagine, is an obstetrician. And he could find nothing the matter with her until she told him that she lived with a drunk. And this explained a great many things to him, and he sent her home to me with an announcement. And I had this one room in this house. This is a very pleasant house, and it had a room in there. It was a den, that's what it was. And on the wall of that room, I had erected a shrine. Now, this shrine was not to any saint that you ever heard of. This shrine was to me. And there were pictures of O'Keefe with the great and the near great. And there were diplomas, and there were plaques, and there were mementos and proclamations, just like Tully had. And I had pictures and letters, you know, Dear Ray, best regards, Jack, that kind of stuff was all over the wall. And I would sit and watch the television, and I'd get my load. And they would put on a commercial, and I'd look up at the wall, and I'd think, you are some piece of work. So Mrs. O'Keefe came to pay a visit to the shrine this evening. And the message that she brought me was that her doctor, the obstetrician, had diagnosed her husband, the professor, as an alcoholic. Oh, I was so upset. I rose and began one of my patented jury addresses, and the first point I made was a good point. I took a very, very dim view of a physician who would diagnose a patient without having seen him. I was against that type of shabby medical practice. And then I asked her a question to which she has not yet discovered the answer. I asked her what kind of a man became an obstetrician in the first place. All right? And at this point, the conversation was going downhill at a terrible rate. And then it happened. And I don't know how this happened. I cannot explain to you how this happened. I am unable to explain to you how this happened. I can explain many, many other things to you, and I probably will in the second or third hour of this terrific talk that I'm doing to you. But in the middle of all of this confusion and all of this noise, I suddenly stopped, and I admitted that there was at least the possibility that I drank too much sometimes. This was a very serious tactical error. Because 3 days later, I found myself a prisoner in a mental institution in Stamford, Connecticut. And I'd only been there a matter of moments when I discovered a very serious architectural deficiency in the building. There was no doorknob on my side of the door. They had sandbagged the old professor. And I was overcome with great feelings of outrage and self-pity because in addition to these outrageous circumstances in which I, an innocent person, found himself, it also happened to be the occasion of my 35th birthday. And I explained this to a man in a white coat who was passing by. And I very carefully explained to that cretin that on that very day, I had attained age 35, and therefore, under the Constitution of the United States of America, I was eligible for the office of president. He urged me not to plan any campaign. He said there were two other presidents in residence. Washington and Jefferson were spending the weekend. And he went away and he left me. And so I spent the next week or so doing all of those warm, wonderful, happy, and interesting things that alcoholics do when they withdraw from alcohol. I shook and I sweat and I did everything else that wonderful that you can think about. And I finally come up for air, and I was then visited by the staff of the hospital. And they, of course, were psychiatrists. And this was a very, very fancy rattlebox, as befitted a man of my position. And the first one in to see me was the head of the hospital, and I would have expected no one less. And he fixed his cool, professional glance upon me, and he asked me that question that so many people insist on asking alcoholics. It's such a brilliant line of inquiry. He said, "Tell me, Professor, why do you drink so much?" So I told him of my wealthy parents. I told him that Momsy and Dada used to travel a lot, and I had been left in the hands of cruel servants who were black. And I had become insecure and turned toward alcohol. And he was very sympathetic. Very understanding person. And he went away, and about an hour later, one of his colleagues came in, and he asked me the same question. So I told him, after all, one doesn't lie to a professional. I told him of my impoverished youth. I told him of the beatings I had received at the hands of my drunken mother. I even told him about the time my sister Marie stole my rubber duck when I was 3 years of age. He told me I'd come to the right place. Said that help was at hand. Said that with his help and the help of medical science, one day I could drink safely again. And I said, "Thank you, doctor." He was my kind of a doctor, that doctor. And the last one in to see me, and the last one I've ever seen, with the exception of one I used to take the meetings from time to time, the last one to see me was a gentleman of dubious medical qualifications and a pronounced Middle European accent. And he was fascinated by two things. One was my professorial status, and the other was the fact that I was wearing sneakers in January. He found some kind of a mysterious relevance to the sneakers, something that had escaped me completely until he mentioned it. So we had a long chat about the footwear, and he finally asked me the question, so I told him. I gave him a sexual aberration that drove him out of the room. He thought he had given a great degenerate to work with, and perhaps he had. Well, I wasn't as smart as I wanted everybody to think, because they had a staff meeting, and they came to the conclusion that there was a fraud in their hospital. And so I was informed that I was in grave danger of being expelled from our mental institution on the grounds of non-cooperation. So I was back where I was staying there in this place, and I was in the day room, and I was playing. I had my own form of therapy, my own way to combat the disease of alcoholism. I was playing Monopoly with three other guys who weren't alcoholics. They were just there. And we had a 24-hour Monopoly game going, and one of them was under the impression that I was his real estate broker. And if you know anything about the game of Monopoly, and some nut thinks that you're his real estate broker, you can do very, very well. And I had the boardwalk, had a number of hotels, and I was was very happy with the Monopoly Marathon, and I was into about 2 days of it, and they told me I had a visitor, and I didn't know what that would be, so I went to my large executive-type padded cell and waited for my visitor. And through the door of that room came this very imposing-looking guy, and he said that he was from the Darien, Connecticut group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that the hospital had given up on me, and they had asked him to come to speak to me about our program. And I immediately reverted to type. I almost had him by the throat. I said, "Alcoholics Anonymous, what are you out of your mind?" And I started. And he told me to shut up. Oh, really? Tacky. I understood and forgave him because I immediately understood that they had neglected to tell him who I was. So I continued to speak. He told me to sit down and to shut up and to listen to him. Well, he was an imposing-looking person, and I was not well. And so for the first time in 35 years, I sat, and he began to explain to me, as I have been trying to indicate to you, and as we are instructed in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, what his life had been like, how he had come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and what life had been for him since. And he asked me if I would like to go with him to meetings. And I said, "Do you mean outside to meetings, sir?" And he said, "Outside." I said, "I'll go." Besides that, he gave me matches. And no one else had allowed me to have any matches. And I thought that showed a certain degree of confidence in the old boy. So that's how it began with me. And this was in January of 1963. And he took me to meetings every night. And he was very devoted. And he made arrangements for me to go locally. And I got loose after about a month and came back and began to attend meetings locally. And I don't recall so much of all of that. I was too new and too nervous and too afraid and too everything. And the hospital had turned me loose with a large jar of those pills that they insist on giving alcoholics. And I was eating those and my head buzzed a lot. As one of my friends says, I was dealing with that segment of the medical profession that considers the disease of alcoholism to be caused by some type of a Valium deficiency. And I was walking around buzzing. But I know myself fairly well, and I thought I would come to Alcoholics Anonymous. You would recognize me as a superior person. You would elect me your president. I was always president if I joined an organization. I was president very shortly. I would serve a term as your president. You would give me a plaque. I would put it up on the wall of the shrine. That's it, upward and onward. Well, it didn't quite work out that way. And it will come as no surprise to you, although it was a terrible shock to me, to find that I lasted 10 months without drinking, and at the end of 10 months, I was very, 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 very drunk. And this time, of course, I was drunk with a great difference, because I had turned away from the great power that is in our program. And I was to stay drunk for a period of time, and I won't bring you through it because it just is difficult and it takes too long. Just let me indicate to you that it was, without question, the worst time of my life. It was murder. It was pure and simple murder. I never knew when I would be drinking, and I never knew when I would not be drinking. I never knew when I would begin, and I never knew where I would be once I had finished. I would drink a week, and then I wouldn't drink a month. I would drink a month, and then I wouldn't drink a week. I would drink and come to these meetings. I would come to these meetings, and then I would drink. things began to happen to me that had never happened to me before. And I do not speak to you now of things that happened to me in this period of time that I no longer consider to be significant. I do not speak to you now of the fact that I was dismissed from the faculty and fired as a tenured professor of law, and that all of the things I had accumulated in that position with some degree of honor and integrity over a period of years was taken from me in the space of about 15 minutes.
And integrity over a period of years was taken from me in the space of about 15 minutes. I do not speak to you of the fact that I was in serious, and I mean very serious, personal, professional, and financial difficulties. I do not even speak to you of the fact that I had lost the affection of all those who were around me. All of this happened to me in this period of time, but that is not what I'm speaking to you about. What I now understand and appreciate was happening to me in this period of time was that there was in my case, and perhaps in yours, a terrible, terrible wasting of my spirit. My spirit, that thing that separates me from my cat, that thing that separates me even from each of you, that spirit which gives to this particular form whatever individuality or personality or character that it might have. And this was a spirit which once burned in me so bright. And it was extinguished, and I knew it, and there was nothing that I could do about it. After all, I'd been here, and this didn't work for me. And by this time, I'd been everywhere else. I'd been through the hospitals and the drying out places and the sanitaria. I'd been through the doctors and the nurses, and I'd been through the programs, and I'd been through the jobs and the politicians and the money. And it was always the same. Every avenue that I went up and down, the result was always the same, that I was drunk. And it wasn't though I didn't know about drinking. I knew about drinking. I had a memory. I remembered the neighborhood. I had been to the funerals. I knew about my family. I knew what happened to people that drank the way I drank. And if I gave this matter any thought at all, I thought, well, if this is the way it is, this is the way it is. And so I entered into that gray world where the days are very long and the nights are very dark and the wind blows and we've all known. And I really, truly, truly did not think that it would end as it did. But one day, my time came. My time came one day. I don't know any more about this than you do, but it seems to me that there is a time for all of us. And it seems to me that there is a time for each of us. I say to you that there is a line somewhere beyond which we are simply not permitted to sink. And I say to you that there is a point somewhere below which we simply are not permitted to go. And I say to you that there is a level of pain somewhere beyond which
no human is required to endure. Now, I don't know where this line is for you. I only know what happened to me. And this is a very personal and an individual thing. And it is different in each case. And for some, it may be death. And that's the way it was for my brother Billy. The man called one night from the Veterans Hospital in Minneapolis. And he told me that my brother had died in that hospital, where they had taken him from the Skid Row of Minneapolis. And so my brother and my hero died without friends and without family. I was talking to you about the what we describe in our literature. What I was trying to describe was something that's it's in the 12 and 12 on the 12th step chapter. It's talk of the bottom, the point at which we seem to have to go to before this program can come into our lives. And I told you that this was an individual thing and a personal thing, and it is different in each case, and it truly is, because I've been in long enough to have heard thousands of stories, and I look for that point in the story. I heard it from Frank, and I heard it from Gary. And it is different for each one of us in this. My brother, as I was saying, had to die before he stopped drinking. And he did die in that hospital, and he was alone, I suppose, without friends and without families. But my brother Billy doesn't drink anymore. And that's how he stopped. For other people, it can be something trivial. But the literature tells us, and my experience tells me, that that line is there somewhere. And we all come to it in our own time and in our own way. But come to it we must. And I arrived at a day that really wasn't so different from so many other days. I was 2 or 3 days away from a drink. I was in this place where I worked. I was nervous. I was thirsty. And I thought I'd go downstairs and have a drink. I knew that would make me feel better. But instead of doing that, I was given the great grace to be able to call a longtime friend of mine, who was also a longtime member of this program. And he is my sponsor, and his name is John. And I called John, and John came over to my office, and he looked so good, and I felt so bad. And I asked him what I would have to do in order to be as successful as he was in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And John gave me that look that he has. And he said, don't drink and go to the meetings. You'll be all right. And I didn't want him to tell me that. And I told him that I didn't want him to tell me that. That was much too simple to tell a person like me. And I said, you see, what you really don't understand, John, is that the real problem is this place where I work. So a lawyer of my talent should not be in a place like this. Yeah, he said, well, don't drink, and you go to meetings, you'll be fine. I said, now, you see, John, the other thing is at home, it's even worse, you know, there's the court order, and I can't go up there, and there's all of that trouble. Yeah, he said, well, don't drink, and you go to meetings, that'll straighten right out. I said, now, I'm being sued by Bankers Trust for the money. Yeah, he said, I heard about that. Well, don't drink, and you go to meetings, you'll be fine. I sensed that there was no dialogue there. And so did John, because he made a couple of phone calls, and he took me up to Grand Central, and he stuck me on a train. So about a 40-minute ride up, and about halfway up, I reconsidered. You understand. What did I call him for? I must have panicked. Don't drink, huh? Don't drink. Don't drink my ass. Wait till this train stops. And that was my attitude when I got off the train at Larchmont, and standing on the platform of the station was my mailman, a guy named Al. And Al was then chairman of the world-famous Mamaroneck Group. And Al said, get in a car. And I said, get out of here, Al. You don't hang around with mailmen. And Al said, some guy named John called me about you. Get in the car. So I got in Al's car, and I said, Al, I'm in a lot of trouble, Al. And Al said, well, don't drink. And so if you are foolish enough to seek my advice because I've traveled a great distance to be here, that's it. Don't drink. You go to meetings. You'll be all right. And Al took me that night up to the world's greatest AA group. And I didn't drink that day. And I haven't had a drink since. That was the 24th day of November in 1965. But first I had that day. And I had that day because two members of this fellowship were so filled with the gratitude of this fellowship that they took what God sent that day, a drunken, dishonest, arrogant hulk of a man. And because they were so very grateful for what they had received, they gave me a day. And it is, I hope, that same sense of gratitude that allows me to be here with you. Because like Al and like John and like every sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have this great debt to pay. And this is one of the ways that I do that. And first I had that day, and then I had the other days, and I would see John every morning. He'd find me somewhere in our business and give me my instructions. And I would see Al every night, and I'd get further instructions. And I went to meetings every night. And the time began to go by, and I finally had a few months, and John took me aside one day, and he said, you know, Raymond, you're not really a bad fellow. You hang around pretty good, and you don't drink, and you've been going to the meetings. He said, I want you to understand that there is a great deal more to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous besides not drinking. He said, it is time for you to learn and to understand this program. Said, it's time for you to read the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And because I am the way I am, I said, oh, are you kidding me? I read the book. Rarely have we seen anyone fail. It was thoroughly followed. And he gave me that look. You know that look? That look that long-time members of AA reserve for smart-ass people. And he said, read it again. And I said, yes, John. Because by that time, my sponsor had taken me to the point where I hope your sponsors have taken you, where no matter what he said, ultimately I would say to him, yes, John. And so I began to read again the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was appalled at my initial ignorance. I was appalled at the little that I understood when first I read the book. I had no idea that 100 or so men and women had become sober in this program before that book was written. I did not understand or appreciate that the book crystallizes the experience of these 100 or so men and women as they became sober. I did not know that those men and women had experienced the steps that are contained in the fifth chapter of that book and which were read to us by Karen tonight. I thought when first I came to this meeting and to this fellowship that if I told you my name was Ray O'Keefe, and I was an alcoholic, I was doing something about the first step of our program. And of course, that's my name, and I'm an alcoholic. But the men and the women who founded this program did a great deal more than simply identify themselves as alcoholics. They admitted that they were powerless over alcohol, that their lives were unmanageable. And their lives were unmanageable because they were powerless over alcohol. They were powerless. They had no power. It says in our book that the dilemma of the alcoholic is his lack of power. He has no power. He is powerless. But they didn't drink. And time began to pass for them. And time has passed for me and for the conference here at the lake. And if you come new, time will pass for you. And time has a wonderful way of passing in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It passes one day at a time. And somewhere in these succession of days, these men and these women came to believe that there was a power greater than their own. And they believed that this power could restore them to sanity. And this was not just a casual observation that they made. They believed this. This was part of them, that there was a power greater than their own, and that this power could help them. And so they made a decision to turn over their will and their lives to the care of this power that they had come to believe in, this God as they each understood him. And they were very, very bright, because at a time in the history of our country when no one else had this notion, they considered alcoholism to be a disease. They considered it to be a disease that was physical and mental and spiritual, a disease of the body and of the mind and of the spirit. And when they admitted their own powerlessness and stopped drinking, their bodies responded quickly. When they came to believe that there was a power that could restore them to sanity, they began a mental recovery. It was slower than the physical recovery, but it was perceptible. They could notice it. And when they made that decision, the decision that Tully was talking about, when they made that decision to turn over their will and their lives to the care of God, the decision to turn over their lives wasn't very much. Their lives were unmanageable. But the decision to turn over the will, the alcoholic will, that was the thing that had me in all of those troubles for all of those years. And I never knew it. I was, and sometimes I am, what the book describes, an extreme example of self-will run riot. But when these people were able to make that kind of a decision, when they were truly able to surrender, when they were really able to mean it, when they said, let go and let God, they began not only a spiritual recovery, but they lay down the basis for a spiritual way of life to which you and I are heir. They left that to us. And they were bright enough to know that it isn't enough to simply stop drinking and start praying. A lot of people have tried that. It just doesn't work. They knew that if they were to be successful, somehow they would have to change. And in order to effect this change in themselves, they began a searching and a fearless moral inventory of themselves. They sought to determine the exact nature of their wrongs. And so great was the love and the affection of these people, one for the other, even as I notice and understand the love and the affection of you all, one for each other, that they were able to readmit this inventory to themselves and to this God of their understanding. And then they were able to take it as I was able to take it to John. And to have him tell me the exact nature of my wrongs, I wasn't sober enough to know that. And then they developed an attitude that was difficult for me. They became entirely ready to have God remove all of their defects of character. And with compelling logic, they went to this great power that they believed in, and they humbly asked that power to remove their shortcomings. And it began to work for them. And no matter what else is ever said or written or even thought about our program, the one thing upon which there must be unanimous opinion is that it works. It really works. And you only have to come into this meeting at this place and to be here at this lake to spend the weekend to know that it really works. And they knew that they had not come here alone. They knew that in their lives, as in mine, there was some terrible wreckage. And so they wrote a list of everyone they had ever harmed, and they became willing to make amends to the people on that list. And they didn't just talk about it, they went out and they did it. And you may remember in our literature it describes the first day that Dr. Bob stopped drinking, and he was working, and he got home late that night, and Bill asked him where he'd been. And he said he'd been driving around Akron, Ohio, in his old Buick, mending fences. It's an old Vermont expression. He had been making amends the very first day that he began to stop drinking. And I don't think that we need wait so long in this program to do everything that's required of us. And they knew by this time they had done their amends and great benefits had come into their lives. And in the big book they describe in the pages, I think it's 83, the promises that follow the painstaking, it says, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will enjoy peace and we will understand serenity. It says that no matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will leave us. That we will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. That fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. That we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us all of the things that we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly. They will always materialize if we work for them. And they knew at this stage of this development of theirs that what had been given to them was something very precious, and so they resolved to maintain it. And in order to maintain it, they continued to take personal inventory. They knew they could not enjoy the luxury of a resentment. They knew they could not be resentful or hateful, that if they were hateful, they would drink. And if they drank, they would die. It was simple with them. And so, when they were wrong, they promptly admitted that they were wrong. And so great and so true and so real was their reliance upon this power greater than their own, that they resolved that they would improve their conscious contact with this power. And they did that by prayer and by meditation. They meditated. They gave thought to their condition. They considered who they were and what they were. And they engaged in a very fine and very excellent form of meditation. It is the form of meditation in which you are now engaged. They listened. They listened. On the odd chance that this power that they believed in would speak to them. And this power that they believed in did speak to them in their groups, at their meetings. And then they prayed, brothers, they prayed. And when they prayed only for knowledge of God's will for them and the power to carry that out. Great benefits came to them when they prayed. I don't know how ever it was with you, but it always seemed to me, when I was young and coming along, I always had this terrible feeling that I didn't belong. I thought I was in the wrong family, the wrong neighborhood, the wrong schools, the wrong people. I always felt that there was something the matter. I really didn't belong where it was I happened to be. And this was true even though the outside, the package, was moving through the system fairly well. I was a successful kid. I was good at school. I was good at the work that I did. I was accepted where I went, but I always felt that I didn't belong. And even though I was enjoying the success and all the rest of it going through, there was this hole in the middle where the wind blew, and it got very quiet. And then I came to this program and learned to pray. And the 12 and 12 tells us in the chapter on the 11th step that one of the great benefits of prayer is that a great sense of belonging comes to us. We are no longer lost or frightened or alone or purposeless. That despite all of the evidence in the world around us, we understand that the real values of life are truth and justice and love. And we understand that a loving God watches over us, and that when we turn to Him, all will be well with us here and hereafter. And I can truly report to you that because of the prayer in this program and the power of this program, that great sense of belonging has come to me. And when I tell you that I am Ray O'Keefe, an alcoholic and a member of that group, I am telling you who I am and what I am and where I belong. And that's very important to me, to know where I belong. It is important to me to know, as Frank said last night, that I belong here. I'm supposed to be at this lake tonight. I'm supposed to be with you. I belong here. And more than that, I am not just a member of my group. I belong to my group. My group directs just about everything I do. I belong to them. A little later in their development, they came upon another prayer, these men and these women to whom we owe our lives. And this time they prayed only for themselves. And you and I have already prayed that prayer. And the only thing they asked was peace of mind. And so they asked God to grant them the serenity to accept the things they could not change. And they did change. Something happened to them. Something happened to these men and women. Something has happened to me. Something will happen to you if you are new. Something happens to everyone who comes here and puts their lives into this program and puts this program into their lives. There was a great difference in these men and women. There was a great difference between being drunk and being sober. And this difference, this conversion of their attitudes, this substitution of their standards, this difference in these men and these women, they termed a spiritual awakening. And they had that spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And these were the men and the women who at the beginning of this process had admitted that they were helpless and hopeless and powerless. These were the ones who had no power, but having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, they found that they held in their hands and in their hearts and in our program one of the greatest sources of spiritual power that the world has ever seen. They actually had the power to arrest the disease of alcoholism. They actually had the power to save life. And the only thing they were using was the great power of example, of one drunk for another. And armed with that power, and having had that kind of a spiritual awakening, they began to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffered. And they have done that so well that you and I have come together on a night in September of 1982 in this very, very beautiful place in the Sierras. And that, my dear, dear sisters and brothers, is a long, long way from Akron, Ohio. And they knew. They knew what my sponsor knew. They knew that what had been given to them was something much more than a simple device to keep me from drinking like a pig. They knew that what they had been handed was an entirely new way of living. And in order to enjoy this new way of life, they resolved that they would practice principles in all their affairs. And so where they had been, as I always was, very dishonest, they tried to be honest. Where they had been, as I always was, very arrogant, they tried not to be so arrogant. Happily for me, and perhaps for us all, they said we were not saints. They said it was not a program of spiritual perfection. They said it is a program of spiritual progress. And my sponsor has instructed me, and so I believe that I can progress in this program if I don't drink and go to the meetings. I could keep you for many, many, many more minutes and tell you of all of the marvelous things that have happened in my life, wholly, solely, and simply because I am a member and belong to this fellowship. But I would not keep you that long. If you have a good wish for me, and I am sure you do, please be assured that anything that you might wish for me has already happened in my life. Everything that alcoholism took from me, this program has returned to me. Every title that I once had, every position that I once held, has been given back to me. Plus, all kinds of other things that I wouldn't even take the time to list. I will tell you just one thing that I think important. I bring you the warm and the fraternal greetings of five of my children who are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know why I get applauded for what they did. I don't know if that's a record, but it's a lot of distance. And there are five of them who are sober. There are others who haven't come in yet, and we have our eye on a couple of them. But there is just no way for me to describe to you the joy that brings. And four of them, as it turns out, are members of the world's greatest AA group. And one of them, who is a very famous actor, is traveling around, and he only comes when he's in town. In any event, they're all sober, and so am I. I would be remiss, of course, if I did not thank you, Marlene, and the rest of the committee, who had the great good judgment to invite me here, and to express to you my own personal thanks for the opportunity to be with you, and not only to enjoy your geography, but to enjoy your company and to enjoy your fellowship. I will report back, as I am required to do, by Article 72 of the bylaws of the World Famous Group, and I will tell them of the time that I have spent here, and that during that time you have made me welcome and have made me feel at home. And I assure you that if I give a good report of you to that group, and if they approve of you, there is nothing else you need ever fear. I am sure that when we do close this meeting and when we do pray, we will remember our brother who suffered during the meeting. I don't take any personal responsibility for that, but I think it's a good suggestion if we remember him. As you probably have heard, I am one of the speakers in AA who gets to travel a great deal. And every time I speak, I say the same thing, and I don't apologize for that. I just say the same thing when I speak. And when I end the same way, and I'm now ending. And I bring you to a pamphlet that is dear to me, the Member's View of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that pamphlet at the end, the author takes a biblical turn. And he reminds us of the time when John the Baptist was once again languishing in one of Herod's prisons. And John sent two of his friends to inquire of his cousin Jesus as to whether or not he was the Messiah. And so these two men walked with the Lord, and they stopped him one day. And they said to him, "Are you the Messiah? Are you the one that we have been waiting for? Or should we wait for another?" And the Lord really didn't answer that question, but he said to these two men, "Go back to John and tell John only what you have seen and only what you have heard. Tell John that the blind see and the lame walk. And tell John that the deaf hear and the sick are made well. And tell John that the gospel is brought to the poor." In my early training, I was told that the word poor in that context could mean poor in spirit. And we all know that the word gospel simply means good news. And so, my dear sisters and brothers, in this wonderful place, in happy conference assembled, if you will accept a report from me based upon my years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I will tell you only what I have heard and only what I have seen. And based upon that observation, it seems to me that the blind do see, and the lame do walk. And I know that the deaf can hear. And most certainly, the sick are made well. And I have seen over and over and over again through the longest day and into the darkest night the good news of our program brought to the alcoholic who still suffers, the poor in spirit. Thank you.